may recall, relates to the standard deviation in a process. Standard deviation is a measure of variation. When we have variation in inputs or variation in how work is performed, we will have variation in outcomes. Six Sigma implores us to root out the sources of variation and establish greater precision in how work is conducted. Six Sigma refuses to accept the idea that to err is human and seeks to eliminate the sources of error, not the people, mind you, but the actions they perform that lead to error and defects. By definition, Six Sigma performance is achieved when defects number fewer than 3.4 per 1 million opportunities for defect. Achieving that level of defect-free performance is not very attainable in human-driven processes, such as those found in most services. But whether an organization achieves 6 sigma, 4 sigma, or 2.5 sigma is not what really matters. What matters is whether the company and its processes are improving. That's the name of the game. And if you're improving faster than your competition, that bodes very well for your future. Keep in mind that the enemy of Lean and Six Sigma is complacency. As soon as you feel like your service is good, maybe better than anyone else's, and that's enough, brace yourself for the fall. If there were such a thing as business obituaries, they'd be littered with companies that were on top of the world only to vanish when they thought they had it all figured out. Consider giant retailers Montgomery Ward, Blockbuster, and Circuit City. There are many more such examples. One business theory that's been drawing a lot of attention lately is service-dominant logic, which to some degree unites the principles of service operations and production operations. Service-dominant logic, or SDL as it's known, suggests that businesses move away from the marketing of goods to a notion of co-creation of value. The idea is that when I buy running shoes, what I'm actually buying is something more. It's my ability to employ the shoes in the pursuit of everything that I enjoy about running. The fitness, the experience of the great outdoors, and the ability to run as fast and free from injury as possible. There's an ongoing relationship between me and the footwear. Together, we create the outcomes that I seek. And that creates new business opportunities for the running shoe company. This is a fundamentally different way to view a product and in turn to sell the product. It's not an end in its own right, but part of a solution. We see similar transitions to a solution orientation occurring in many different industries. Xerox, for example, has moved away from selling copiers to business customers. Instead, it installs a multifunction copier in an office, and the customers charge for its use based on pages copied and documents scanned, printed, and mailed. Apple has me hooked with apps. It allows me to constantly refresh my iPhone with information and entertainment content that I seek, even as my interests evolve. For both Xerox and Apple, this shift in orientation has turned what might have been one-time sales into lucrative ongoing revenue streams. Notice that there is a physical product at the center of the services that Xerox and Apple provide. The new focus, however, is on a creative solution that doesn't involve dumping the product in the lap of the customer and then walking away. Rather, it involves establishing and maintaining a relationship with the customer. It becomes much more difficult for competitors to sway customers with grandiose promises when customers trust that you'll deliver desired outcomes reliably. Effective service operations are the key to managing high-performing relationships successfully. And that's one big reason why they're growing in importance. Think about how your business can seize this moment where services increasingly dominate the business landscape.
This lecture is titled, Matching Supply and Demand.
A few years back, I was conducting a workshop with a group of production and distribution managers from a large consumer goods company. We were talking about the challenge of sales and operations planning. when one by one their smartphones started buzzing, directing their attention away from the class. And one by one the managers excused themselves to attend to something urgent. When we reconvened for lunch a few hours later, I took the opportunity to ask what had happened. They explained that their sales organization had cut a deal with a major customer on one of their company's products. And these production and distribution managers were the last people to hear about it. When they got the word, they had to scramble to see if they could actually deliver on the sales team's promises. So the managers were struggling with the very problem that had been trying to show them how to avoid. This lecture is devoted to that same subject, sales and operations planning, or S&OP. It's a proven method for finding the balance between promise making and promise keeping. The process itself consists of the integration of a company's sales forecast with the operations plans from the purchasing, production, and logistics departments. We'll examine the specific inputs and organizational requirements needed to achieve this balance. So let's get started. First, a little context. Why is it that there's a chasm between sales and operations in the first place? Why do we need a formal process to bring these parts of a business together? To say that businesses are complex organizations is an understatement. Most businesses are composed of different departments, departments like sales, marketing, accounting, purchasing, production, logistics, R&D, and human resources. Why? Because this is the way that we deal with complexity. We divide and conquer. We become specialized, developing knowledge and skill sets that allow us to perform specific functions. And this makes more sense to us than building an organization full of generalists, people that might have a mile wide but inch deep knowledge about how to run the business. While a functional orientation helps us to make sure that we cover all the bases in our organization, it's sometimes difficult to establish balance and coordination across the departments. This is particularly true when we find the departments in conflict with one another. There's the natural tendency in times of conflict to retrench and to defend turf, rather than to give in and pursue outcomes that might benefit the collective good. And companies often have measurement systems in place that reinforce functional silos and turf wars. Perhaps the greatest divide found in an organization is the one between demand and supply sides of the business. The customer-facing departments responsible for generating demand, namely sales and marketing, are held accountable for top-line revenue, sometimes at any cost. Meanwhile, the supply-side operations departments found in the business like purchasing, production, and logistics have the responsibility of delivering on that demand, but doing so at the lowest possible cost so that at the end of the day, the company nets margins and profits. These two forces find themselves at odds with one another. The promise makers in sales and marketing blame the operations folks for an inability to satisfy the demand that they've so tirelessly tried to create. Meanwhile, the operations personnel take offense with what they see as sales and marketing's very casual approach to making promises that probably shouldn't have been made in the first place, putting them in an impossible spot from time to time. Why is it important to address this gap? To get promise makers and promise keepers on the same page? When we fail to deliver on customer orders or have to temper demand, that impacts our credibility in the marketplace and creates opportunities for our competitors. Undersupply opens the door for the competition. Yet when we oversupply the market, we're left with excess inventory that must either be marked down or written off. When we fall into the trap of marking down inventory time and again, customers get conditioned to expect the markdowns. They learn to wait and refuse to pay full price. My wife knows that Macy's will mark down Christmas cards by 75% every December 26, and she's always poised to pounce on these predictable clearance sales. So with undersupply, we can expect blows to customer confidence, potentially losing sales in the immediate and long term. And with oversupply, we incur the cost of holding excess inventory or aggressive discounting that runs the risk of watering down the brand. Sales and operations planning was designed to address this problem. The concept was developed by management consultants at the consulting firm of Oliver White in the 1980s. Now, the 1980s were a time in which personal computer technology was just being harnessed to address complex everyday problems. With a proven method, technology to support it, and successful case studies at major companies, word of S&OP spread very fast. Soon, businesses everywhere were pursuing the improvements in forecast accuracy, productivity, sales, on-time delivery, and inventory savings that they'd been hearing about. So where do we sign up? What are the inputs to S&OP? How is it done? Fundamentally, S&OP is about gathering and sharing information. So the first step is to form an S&OP team of departmental representatives from within your company and gain the buy-in of the parties involved. If the process fails to fully involve the sales and operations departments, the effort's without hope. But the process really should also involve other key stakeholders in the discussion of the company's key resources, including departments like finance, HR, and new product development. It's important to have these areas well represented in planning discussions. Being well represented means having senior leaders from these departments on the S&OP team. Sending a junior member to participate in this process will not help to advance it. For one, the junior member lacks the authority to make critical decisions for the department. And two, it signals a marginal commitment from the senior leaders. Either could stop the process in its tracks. Just getting to the stage of the organization agreeing to resolve conflict that has brewed over a long period of time can be a major hurdle for some companies. In one extreme example, I heard of a CEO sacking a marketing executive because the exec refused to participate to the level necessary for success. The CEO, intent on making S&OP a reality at his company, put the executive who was in charge of distribution in charge of marketing too. Concentrate the responsibility with one person, ensuring that no one would get in the way. Again, that's an unusual example, but it sent a clear message of the CEO's intent. It helps if someone known and respected in the organization is tabbed with a leadership role for the S&OP process. It should be a primary responsibility for this person, and not just one of many side jobs. As the term S&OP suggests, the key function of the S&OP team is planning. The sales and marketing representatives should work together to bring forward the sales picture for the coming months. The purchasing, production, and logistics reps prepare capacity plans with ready explanations for any anticipated changes in operating capacity. Finance and HR are present in consultative roles related to how financial and human resources might be deployed in the business. New product development can speak to the readiness and timing of new product launches that can be expected to siphon resources from existing products. Not many among us enjoy meetings, but a well-managed monthly meeting proves more effective than merely distributing spreadsheets around the organization. The face-to-face meeting is important for quickly resolving discrepancies and conflicts. The idea is that all parties leave the meeting with a common vision of what's expected in the coming month and committed to doing their part to fulfill the vision. And there's something about making commitments eye to eye that helps make them stick. Considerable work takes place within each department leading up to the monthly summit. Sales and marketing should collaborate to coordinate promotions and any strategies that might be in place to bolster sales. The generation of a sales forecast can be one of the trickiest propositions in all of business. It represents the department's best guess of the future. But it can be disheartening to realize that the only absolute about a forecast is that it will be wrong. The only question is whether it will be an over-forecast, overshooting the actual sales, or an under-forecast, shooting too low, and how large the forecast error will be. The further out the forecast, the greater the propensity for error. It's like throwing a dart at a dartboard in many ways. The further back you stand, the less likely for a bullseye strike and the more likely you'll miss the board entirely. Step up a little and your accuracy improves. For that reason, we put more faith in short-term forecasts than the longer-term variety. The forecast for the upcoming 1 to 3 month period is pretty typical in the S&OP process. Another tricky component to sales forecasting is the value-laden nature of it. What I mean is that a sales organization that shoots too low can be regarded as overly cautious, lax, or sandbagging, setting low expectations. This can happen when salespeople are rewarded for sales exceeding the forecast. Yet a sales organization that routinely overestimates their forecasted sales soon gets figured out too, and their numbers lose credibility. Allow me to provide a short review of the most common forecasting methods. Forecasts come in one of two different varieties, qualitative or quantitative. Qualitative forecasts are essentially best guesses. They are forecasts made without the necessary data. That said, they should not be shots in the dark. No, they're expert-based opinions. The experts are those people who are closest to the market, the field sales representatives, who can comment on what's going on in their respective markets. Marketing experts back at the headquarters will usually weigh in too. They base their judgments on market intelligence, including trends for the sales of related items, demographic changes occurring in the markets, and the responses to market inquiries and field testing of the products or services in question. In the absence of any sales history, qualitative estimations will be the best options available. This is especially true for those new-to-the-world items that have never been introduced before. Such was the case with the Segway personal scooters some years back. Do you know the ones I'm talking about? Those two-wheeled devices that you drive by leaning to and fro? You're likely to see them in major airports or at tourist destinations like Miami South Beach or San Francisco's Pier 39. The world had never seen such a thing before. Would people give up driving, walking, or riding bicycles to use a Segway scooter? These were the questions that the inventors had to ask themselves. At the end of the day, their initial sales forecast were best guesses pulled out of the air with some backing from data grounded in related activities and products. Quantitative forecasting methods come in many different forms. They rely on numbers, data from past sales of the same item, ideally. In the absence of this information, you might use historical sales of similar items or complementary items. An example of similar items might be replacement doors and windows for a house. The two may be replaced at a similar rate. Complementary items might be PCs and monitors, as they're often sold together. If you have data for the sales of one item, you can deduce the demand for a similar or complementary item. When we use figures for such past sales, we call it a time series forecast because we're projecting from the past into the future. The easiest but least informed quantitative forecast is that of the simple average. In a simple average, you might look at the average sales over an entire year and divide by 12 months. So if you sell 1,200 units in a year, the average is 100 units per month. You'd simply expect to sell that same volume month over month. The moving average technique looks at recent history only. You might look at just the past 3 months, for instance, to gauge the anticipated sales for the month ahead. If we were to see sales of 100, 200, and 300 for the previous 3 months, our average over that time is 200 units. Exponential smoothing is a forecasting method that acts a little differently, and it involves a simple formula. It looks at the previous month's sales forecast as well as the actual sales from that same month. We then apply what is called an alpha value. That governs how much weight or emphasis we would place on each factor in the calculation. The alpha value is a subjective value that is based on expert opinion. It's also known as the smoothing factor. Alpha will range from 0 to 1. A large alpha above 0.5 places more emphasis on actual sales from last month. And then the balance of 1 minus alpha is applied to the forecasted value from last month. We multiply actual sales times alpha and the forecasted sales by 1 minus alpha. When we add the two composites, you get the forecasted value for the coming month. Smoothing is intended to take some of the emotion out of the forecast, while still relying on recent data. By including the forecasted value from the previous month, you are carrying a smoothing influence forward month to month. When an item's been in existence for quite some time, you can rely on sales data to track trends, seasonality, or cyclical influences. All of these factors and many more can be integrated into a regression analysis forecast. The regression method offers a predictive model that allows many factors to be considered at once. The unique influence of trends, seasons, and cycles can be determined from the regression, as can the influence of many other factors for which data exist. In the case of the sale of football tickets, other factors might include the average temperature or number of rainy days in the month. I'll admit that I'm a fair weather fan. This level of detail makes regression a very powerful forecasting method. Most companies employ a combination of quantitative and qualitative forecasting methods. The ideal approach is to generate a quantitative forecast as a baseline, using whichever quantitative method you prefer. Experts can then weigh in on those numbers. Was there anything unusual in recent months that affected the historical data? Is there anything expected in the road ahead that could also affect the forecast? Blending historical data with expert opinion brings together the best of both worlds, letting the data speak and providing a forward view, plus an occasional voice of reason, allows us to employ objective and subjective inputs in bringing forward our best guess of the future. Like any process, forecasts can always be improved. Leading companies devise multiple forecasts using different methods and learn over time which methods prove most effective. They then continue to challenge and revise those models. Now for the other side of the sales and operations planning equation, the capacity to accommodate this demand. There are three capacities that we generally concern ourselves with. These include the capacities of supply, production, and the combination of logistics and distribution. Limits in any of these can impair our ability to accommodate the expected demand found in the sales forecast. This is the check to ensure we only make promises we're confident of keeping. Supply capacity is something that likely rests beyond the direct control of your firm. It's dependent on the capacity of your suppliers and your ability to extract supplies from them. The typical experience is that you have a wide range of suppliers. Some seem able to offer limitless supplies, and others present constraints. The constraints may be absolute, meaning there are limits to their ability to serve you, or the added volume may simply come at a higher price. You need to understand both of these, as they can influence the volume of supplies you can acquire in total and at what price. Supply and production capacity come together in the Materials Requirements Plan, or MRP, which expresses the quantity and timing of supplies required to feed production. The Materials Requirements Plan is usually driven by the production forecast, which is often expressed in yet another three-letter acronym, the Master Production Schedule, or MPS. This schedule illustrates what the company expects to produce over a period of time, often a month, and can be broken down into weekly or even daily plans for production. Clearly, the sales forecast should influence this production forecast. The difference in the two forecasts can be capacity constraints in production, or preference by production to make something different. Why would production elect to make something different? It could be that the production planners have learned over time that the sales forecast isn't so accurate, and they make their own adjustments. Or it could be that the production department has incentives in place that might influence its preferences. It's common, for instance, for a company's executives to evaluate production performance based on costs per unit produced. When that's the case, production management is inclined to pursue economies of scale, producing the items that they can build at the lowest cost and running them in very large batches. It's a gaming of the system for sure, but it's extremely common. This kind of gamesmanship should be put to rest with an effective S&OP process, because the process puts sales and production in direct communication with each other so they can understand each other's goals and constraints. The third capacity plan that we bring to the S&OP table is the one for logistics and distribution. Here we may have capacity constraints on how much product we can store and move over a period of time. That capacity may be limited to the space in our warehouses, the size of our storerooms, or the number of transportation vehicles that we have at our disposal. You may own these capacities, or you might have to hire outside companies to provide you with the space and transport you require. Similar to hiring outside suppliers, you might run into a spike in prices when you demand more than your fair share of these outside capacities. Again, this is knowledge that needs to be brought to the table. With the compilation of the sales forecast and capacity plans for supply, production, and logistics and distribution, you have what you need to make decisions at your S&OP planning meeting. The goal of the meeting is to come up with a single set of numbers that everyone will work toward in the coming period. The S&OP process doesn't end with agreement on the common set of numbers, however. Once you're into the month and sales start to trickle in, everyone needs to communicate when the forecast looks to be falling apart, and we know that it will. Also, the same could be said of our operations plans. Countless forces could be at work threatening to alter our best-laid plans for meeting the demand. When a crisis or new constraint presents itself, that too should be communicated so that the sales team can direct demand away from the affected products or offer adjusted delivery dates to navigate the situation. The often forgotten component of S&OP is flexibility. Flexibility that you need to build into your operations to accommodate the unexpected. The more flexible your operations, the more variation that your system can accommodate, and the less likely that your customers will experience any negative consequence due to fallible planning. However, should you not be able to accommodate customer needs, there comes a time to make tough choices. You must devise priorities when the constraints prove too much and supply cannot meet demand. Among the hard decisions is figuring out which products to supply or produce when capacities are limited. Also, when distribution capacity is constrained or the inventory of goods faces shortage, we must decide who to serve with our limited supplies. Do we serve customers on a first-come, first-served basis, or do we reserve the short supply for our most valuable customers? It doesn't make everyone happy, but you can see why companies want to make sure that their best customers don't get shorted. Customers with high-status membership in their airline's frequent flyer programs rarely get bumped from oversold flights, right? The airlines are practicing good demand management there. Well, I hope that you're seeing the benefit of achieving balance between supply and demand through S&OP. What we've talked about thus far is actually called enterprise S&OP. That is S&OP for a single company. But S&OP can be applied more broadly than that. What if we apply these principles in managing the supply and demand across companies in the supply chain, meaning our entire system of inputs, outputs, and distribution? That is, what if we collaborate with our suppliers and customers to see if a common vision of the business we will conduct together? A classic example points to why we should try to iron out the kinks in our supply and demand plans across company boundaries in the supply chain. Way back in 1958, an article appeared in the Harvard Business Review by Professor Jay Forrester of MIT. Professor Forrester documented something called demand amplification. Let me set the scenario for you. Picture a supply chain with multiple levels. A manufacturer distributes product to a distribution center. Distributors buy product from the manufacturer's distribution center. And the distributor sells product to retailers who sell to consumers like you and me. So inventory flows from the manufacturer toward retailers, and demand then flows in the reverse direction. Professor Forrester examined what happens when demand for an item suddenly increases by a mere 10% at the retail level. In his research, he found that retailers usually require a little time before they detect the small rise in demand. Once recognized, they don't know exactly where that demand will level off, so they increase their orders on the distributor by 16%. Now imagine that you're the distributor. You suddenly receive an order that is 16% higher than normal. Like the retailer, you don't know where this demand will tail off, so you try to get ahead of it and increase your order on the manufacturer's distribution center by 28%. You see where this is going, right? The distribution center sees a spike of 28% and extrapolates the surge to try to get ahead of it, placing an order on the factory that is 40% larger than normal. The factory then must react to this surge and increases production by 40%. This is all in reaction to an actual change in demand at retail of 10%. So we may not have the inventory when we need it, but when the supply chain catches up, it catches up in spades. We're left with tons of excess inventory, which may over time have to be flushed or sold at a deep discount just to clear it out. Today, the phenomenon is known as the bullwhip effect. And despite advanced technologies and an air of cooperation among businesses, the bullwhip effect phenomenon remains alive and well, more than a half century after Professor Forrester first documented it. The solution to this problem requires planning across company lines with select customers and suppliers. We refer to this as integrated S&OP or integrated business planning. Closely related is the concept of collaborative planning, forecasting, and replenishment, which goes by the acronym CPFR. As of this taping, grocery retailers and their vendors have been using CPFR for about 20 years. While it takes considerable time to coordinate plans and actions across the companies, integrated S&OP and CPFR dramatically reduce the surprises that have become an unfortunate but common experience in doing business. Also, case studies show that more customers find what they want in stock with less inventory in the system. That's a win-win. We ordinarily expect to add inventory to improve in-stock performance. Instead, companies are replacing inventory with the ready exchange of information. As you can imagine, one key factor in all of this, information sharing coordination, is the use of advanced information technologies. One popular technology is Enterprise Resource Planning, or ERP. Many large companies are using ERP systems effectively to gather and share essential data within the company, but increasingly with trusted suppliers and customers too. Also, ERP is becoming more accessible for small and medium enterprises, thanks to the rise of cloud computing and companies that offer software as a service. Yet more important than the technology is a willingness to share critical data, whether by electronic means or otherwise. Many companies find that the telephone still works just fine for this purpose. Let me summarize with an analogy. Imagine a seesaw. On one end is a big box labeled demand. On the other end are two smaller boxes labeled capacity and inventory. Positioned in the middle of the seesaw board is the fulcrum upon which the board rests. And the fulcrum is labeled plan. Our seesaw is in balance when the weight of the capacity and inventory together counter the weight of demand. If demand were to grow in size, we would need more weight in capacity and or inventory to bring the seesaw back into balance. Yet there's another possibility. Ah, the fulcrum. What if we were to move the fulcrum, the plan, closer to the demand side of the seesaw? With that action, we get more leverage from the capacity and inventory that we already have. The lesson here is that if we can plan closer to demand, that is, if we can forecast more accurately in the short term, then we need less capacity and inventory to fulfill the demand. The answer is sharing information and collaborating within our companies to find that balance between demand and supply. Now imagine lining up multiple seesaws side by side and working with people at each one to find the right balance for each of the seesaws in tandem. That would represent the notion of integrated business planning across companies in the supply chain. No doubt, it's a challenge, but it's one that yields huge benefits for its players.
This lecture is titled, Right Sizing Inventory.
Inventory can be among the most valuable assets for a company. It certainly feels that way when you don't have enough to feed your business or to serve your customers. But having too much inventory can be a bad thing too. Even though it just sits there, inventory can consume a lot of resources in your business, resources that could be put to more productive use elsewhere. How big a factor is inventory in a company's business? At any point in time, U.S. businesses are holding more than $2 trillion in inventory. The Department of Commerce generates a measure each month called the Inventory to Sales Ratio, or IS ratio, which compares inventory levels to sales. That number usually runs in the range of 1.30. That means that U.S. businesses typically hold about 30% more inventory at any point in time than what they're selling. In this lecture, we'll explore the fundamentals of right-sizing inventory through inventory management. The main goal of inventory management is to determine what to inventory and in what quantities in order to maintain just the right amount of inventory, no more and no less. Why do companies hold inventory in the first place? In hopes of generating sales. It's hard to sell what you don't have. And we fear disappointing a customer. A stockout is when we fail to serve a customer because we lack the inventory. And customers can react in any number of ways to a stockout. They might be courteous and accept a back order, a rain check, if you will, a promise to provide the goods once we have the inventory available. Increasingly, though, they're not so understanding. Instead, they're likely to look for a substitute item. If they're brand loyal customers, they might look for the item at another location or seek out a different supplier. But they're also prone to getting frustrated and giving up on the product altogether. What if they like the substitute just as well? Or they tell their friends about the stockout and suggest that they try a different store. Clearly, the residual effects of a single stockout can be substantial in today's highly competitive markets. But holding inventory is expensive. How expensive? Businesses measure the financial impact of holding inventory in the form of something called inventory carrying cost, or holding cost. The more inventory you hold, the higher the carrying cost. The primary component of inventory carrying cost is the opportunity cost of capital, having money tied up in inventory that could be put to use somewhere else in the business. In other words, if you had $10,000 of inventory, what else could you be doing with it? Maybe you could invest in new products or new technology. You could invest in training and education of your staff, or maybe upgrading facilities. The point is, there are other uses for that capital than having it tied up in a not-so-liquid asset. This is especially true for cash-strapped companies. In addition to the opportunity cost of capital, other factors that might go into inventory carrying cost calculation include insurance and taxes associated with holding inventory. There are also aspects of risk to holding inventory, including the risk of inventory becoming damaged, stolen, obsolete, spoiled, or out of date. Inventory carrying cost aside, what are the other key metrics for inventory management performance? The most talked about one is inventory turns. The measure of inventory turns offers us a picture of inventory velocity. Of course, high velocity means that you're selling the merchandise quickly. Inventory turns can be calculated on an item-by-item basis or across a company for all of its items. The aggregate calculation provides an overall measure of inventory efficiency. It's calculated by dividing cost of goods sold by the dollar value of average inventory. If a company can generate more sales on less inventory, the higher its turns, the more velocity, suggesting a more efficient operation. Wall Street analysts use this measure as a way to assess the overall operational efficiency of a company. The item-specific measure of inventory turns, though, provides a good read on the company's efficiency with respect to an individual item. When it comes down to managing inventory, you really want to have this specific level of knowledge. Fortunately, computerized record keeping of inventory makes this analysis much easier, allowing us to compare the performance of one item against another. For instance, an item that generates 20 turns a year compared to another that generates only 5 turns a year is 4 times as efficient from an inventory standpoint. We might label the 20-turn item as a fast mover and the 5-turn item as a slow mover. Fast and slow moving items can be managed differently in light of the different burdens they impose on the business. But increasingly, companies are using inventory turnover not only as a measure of self-evaluation, but also as a way to evaluate their suppliers. Many large retailers, for instance, are using a measure called gross margin return on inventory, or GMROI, as it's often called, to evaluate the attractiveness of a supplier's goods. GMROI is a hybrid measure that combines gross margin and inventory turns into a single metric. Let's say that an item enjoys a 20% margin for the retail store, but only turns 3 times per year. 0.2 times 3 is 0.6. Some sources claim that an item must generate a 3.2 GMROI score to break even, but that's a very broad guideline. GMROI offers a good way to compare different items within a category. Retailers, for instance, only have so much space in their stores. They have to decide which items to stock and where to stock them. Only select items will get the primo space in the store, the eye-level shelves, or the end-of-aisle displays. Let's examine how a retailer might use this comparative metric. One item provides low margins of 6% but turns weekly, or 52 times per year, for a GMROI of 3.12. The other item has margins of 15% but turns only monthly, 12 times, for a GMROI of 1.8. The retailer would be wise to put more emphasis on the first item than the second and might elect to only stock the first item. This would likely drive sales up for that item, though some customers might be upset by the discontinuation of the second item. It's a difficult decision for sure. Product proliferation, or the growth in the number of items that a company stocks, is among the greatest challenges facing businesses today. Companies are always eager to introduce new items, believing that it drives sales growth, and that's often true. But companies are very reluctant to get rid of items. That results in an ever-growing assortment of items that add cost and complexity. Product proliferation has been described as a cinder block around the neck of the company and its profitability. This is especially true for small businesses. When you're small and trying to grow, you want to promise the world to your customers. But you can't afford to stock the world. The weight of inventory is simply too heavy. And believe it or not, poor cash flow resulting from holding too much inventory can be blamed for more failures among small businesses than almost any other culprit. My daughter Emma loves to cook and watch television programs about cooking. One show that we enjoy watching together features a business expert who helps out troubled restaurants. I'm always amazed at how diverse a menu these restaurant operators present. I mean, a Mexican restaurant that offers chicken wings and spaghetti? No joke. But if an item's on the menu, you'd better have it. And that means you need to keep the ingredients and supplies on hand to cook all those foods. That's inventory. The smarter decision would be to keep those items off the menu, limit the assortment, and focus your efforts. Having only one or a few brands within a product category is the driving strategy of grocery retailers like Save-A-Lot, Aldi, and Trader Joe's with their limited assortment approach. By carrying only one item in most product categories, they can manage their inventory much more efficiently and in turn offer competitive prices for the products they sell. So what are the different strategies that companies can use to manage inventory? There are four basic strategies. We can distinguish them based on how a business interacts with its suppliers in choosing how much to order and how often to order. The most simple option is a fixed quantity, fixed frequency strategy. This is where you order the same quantity every time you need replenishment, and you place this order on a scheduled basis. This is the arrangement that I have with my local newspaper. They deliver precisely one newspaper to me every day. That's a fixed quantity on a fixed frequency. When I head out of town on vacation, I have to contact the newspaper and tell them to stop delivery. When my Buckeyes win a national championship, I might want an extra copy. So I'd need to contact the company and say, hey, send me an extra one. Sadly, that doesn't happen often enough for my liking. With this strategy, you need to figure out how much you want and how often. I read a newspaper each and every day, so that seems about right. But if you're buying something more complex, it requires more thought. Also, some suppliers might impose a minimum order quantity that requires us to buy more than we might prefer. Whether it's of our own choice or imposed on us, the larger order quantity, the less frequently we will need to order supplies. Now, why would a supplier impose a minimum order quantity on us? Because although it doesn't usually get registered as a ledger item, there's such a thing as order processing cost. That's an administrative cost measured in time, effort, and technology used to place an order. And each time that our supplier receives an order from us, they also incur a cost to process the order as well. That's one reason that suppliers impose minimum order policies on small orders, to ensure that they at least cover their cost of doing business. And that's understandable. You've probably seen such a policy when small retailers require a minimum dollar amount for customers making purchases with credit cards, as credit card companies sometimes charge transaction fees to these small businesses. The other three inventory strategies employ what's called reorder point logic. That's fancy language for saying that we track the inventory and reorder when we reach a certain level of on-hand inventory. When we reach the reorder point, it triggers an order. That means that we need to keep an eye on our inventory levels. One strategy doesn't require us to keep close tabs on inventory. Instead, we might check inventory, say, every 5 or 10 days. That would be a periodic review method, or P system, where the letter P stands for a fixed period of review. This strategy also sometimes is referred to as a min-max approach. Once an inventory count is taken and it's realized that a reorder point has passed, managers will order up to a maximum level for that item, a predetermined quantity that you're willing to hold. So the periodic method of inventory management is variable in terms of quantity ordered, but fixed in terms of timing. Companies using this method establish reorder points that are a little higher than when you monitor inventory constantly. As a result of only occasionally checking inventory and having a higher reorder point, they tend to carry a little more inventory. They also run the risk, though, of incurring prolonged stockouts when they're not on top of runs on inventory. Reorder points and maximum levels can be adjusted at different times of the year to better accommodate peak and low seasons, but they should not change often. The periodic review method has given way to strategies that emphasize managing inventory in real time. With today's inventory tracking technologies like barcodes and radio frequency identification, many companies today keep an eye on the inventory at all times and manage accordingly. This allows them to be alerted to items that are running dangerously low and to keep less inventory on average by way of this alertness. So these advanced technologies can often pay for themselves pretty quickly. Of the as-needed inventory strategies, one involves ordering in fixed quantities, and the other allows for variable quantities. Using the fixed quantity strategy, known as a queue system, a company might order as needed in minimum order quantities imposed by the supplier, or the company might determine the quantities that it feels are best. One fixed quantity approach that has been a mainstay for over a century now is something called economic order quantity, or EOQ. The EOQ balances the annual cost of holding inventory and the annual administrative cost of processing orders. Many people continue to be drawn to it based on its simple logic. Ordering in fixed quantities, though, does not take advantage of flexibilities that companies are seeking today. That's why many have advanced to the fourth strategy, where neither the order quantity nor the timing of orders is fixed. This is a just-in-time strategy, which has gained much fame and attention in recent decades. People often associate it with automotive manufacturers like Toyota and Honda. However, just-in-time, or JIT systems, are found in all varieties of industries. The primary difference between JIT and the other three approaches is that we must exert generous diligence on our inventory. It takes a lot of focus and discipline to operate on this basis when inventory is kept to an absolute minimum, yet running out of it can literally shut down the business. For that reason, it's unwise to consider such a system when supplier lead times are long or unreliable. Rather than counting on large lots and infrequent ordering, JIT companies resort to very small order batch sizes and high frequency. When demand is brisk, they increase either the batch size or the order frequency, depending on the cost of doing each. However, the focus is on keeping inventories low and replenishing only what's depleted when it's depleted. Companies often employ a Kanban system to signal demand and the need for replenishment. Kanban is a Japanese term that means signboard. Traditional Kanban systems use paper cards to serve as visual signals of inventory consumption and the need for replenishment. Today, the systems have converted to electronic means using what's called e-Kanbans. Despite their challenges, we see JIT systems in place in many different businesses today. Perhaps foremost in their adoption are hospitals that rely on available stores of medical supplies, devices, and pharmaceuticals. Yet they don't want to buy any more of these extremely expensive, often perishable items than they need. Many believe that better management of our inventories and healthcare supply chains can dramatically reduce our cost of care while also improving the quality of care. As you might expect, inventory is a focal point for companies that embrace lean thinking. Lean thinking, remember, suggests that we eliminate all forms of waste in our businesses so that we're focused on performing value-added work that satisfies customers. work that they're willing to pay for. Inventory is regarded as one of those wastes to eliminate. So rather than viewing inventory as an asset in the business, as its position on the balance sheet would suggest, lean thinkers regard it as a liability. In fact, a gentleman by the name of Taichi Ono, who's often credited with devising the famed Toyota production system, once said, "The more inventory a company has, the less likely they will have what they need." What did Mr. Ono mean by this counterintuitive observation? He seemed to suggest that just because you have a lot of inventory doesn't mean that you have the stuff that customers actually want. In fact, the more inventory you have, the less likely you will have the right stuff. The suggestion is that the inventory can make us very complacent, to feel as if we have everything that we need. It also allows for a sense of disconnection between us, our customers, and suppliers. All of those conditions are bad. It's bad business and doesn't encourage us to get better. The obvious challenge to being lean, though, is the risk of disappointing customers when demand surges or supply is disrupted. And these are risks for sure. How lean companies deal with these risks is the subject of another lecture. Now that we've reviewed the four inventory strategies, which one is best? Well, it doesn't always come down to selecting a single strategy. As noted previously, most companies don't manage a single product, but several different ones. The largest companies, like 3M and General Electric, might have more than a million items that they must track and manage. A large retail store with a modern multi-department format might house 120,000 different items under one roof. Even the simplest of businesses can have an inventory of several hundred items. Clearly, this adds to the complexity of managing inventory and often the need to implement multiple inventory strategies. In order to address this complexity, most companies employ some form of grouping their items across their inventory. The most common is an ABC classification scheme. Under such a scheme, A items are those that sell in high volume, earn high margins, or are sold to the company's best customers. These are the items for which the company tries to ensure ready availability. New products that are in the throes of a major launch might also be labeled as A items. The company may be willing to take on a little more supply of these A's to be certain that they're available, as a stockout on them could be really detrimental to the company. B items are of a somewhat lower priority. We might not need to stock as great a supply, for stockout here would not have the same implications as for A items. B items generally require a closer look to determine exactly how to manage them. If they're relatively new or on the rise, then you might be willing to take on a little more. If they're not expensive from a holding cost standpoint, there again, you might be willing to take on a little more. However, if these items are fading in popularity, easily substituted, or ordered by less important customers, then having lower supply of inventory would be optimal. Finally, C items are those that are on their way out. They may be unprofitable items, costly to keep, or they're on their way to becoming what we call dead stock, having lost their resale value. Given the short life cycle of electronic products today, in light of the quick advances, they can quickly transition from an exciting new A item to a mature B item to a C item in the declining stage. C items should be cleared out to make room for the next new thing. This can happen in less than a year with today's smartphones, for instance. Clearly, you can create a more complex classification scheme by simply adding letters D, E, F, and so on to provide greater granularity. Also, you can create a multi-letter scheme to capture different dimensions with the designation. For example, let's say that we want to manage inventory according to how brisk the sales are for an item, the profitability of the item, and who is buying it. A triple A item is one that is high volume, very profitable, and purchased by our preferred customers. We would manage such an item very differently from, say, a CBC item, which would be slow moving, marginally profitable, and sold to less valuable customers. While we make every effort to ensure availability of the AAA item, the CBC item might be on the chopping block. Or we might choose not to stock it, but rather order it from suppliers only when we receive a request for it. Allow me to share a short case study that illustrates how one small company manages a large array of inventory in multiple locations. Cole Hardware is a family-run business in the San Francisco Bay Area. They operate 4 store locations in the Bay Area, each one stocking a wide array of items that any handy do-it-yourselfer might need for those household jobs. They stock fasteners, tools, fixtures, and much, much more. About 45,000 items at each store location. Everything received by the store gets scanned, and it's added to the computerized inventory management system. Also, items get scanned at the checkout to indicate that they're leaving the inventory. Some items are likely to be high-volume, critical A items, and others are slower-moving, less critical B and C items. Really expensive A items might be managed on a just-in-time basis, an effort to try to ensure availability without taking on expensive inventory. In other instances, one of Cole Hardware's big vendors might require minimum order sizes on such a relatively small customer, requiring a queue system with the same order quantity applied each time the stores need something. Should the store sell bulk construction materials like lumber, gravel, or sand, those materials might be managed on a periodic basis, where the inventory is checked from time to time and ordered up to the level deemed maximum for the season. And some items, like nuts and bolts, might be sold on such a steady basis that they're delivered on a fixed schedule, fixed quantity basis. In other words, it's possible for a single business to employ a multitude of strategies to accommodate different items and their respective demands. Further, it's possible that some items will shift from one strategy to another as they transition from one sales season to another, going from an anticipatory strategy like a queue system in peak season to a response-based GIAT system when the peak demand subsides. In light of the intense focus directed to inventory management in recent years, innovations are always presenting themselves. One innovation I mentioned earlier is the use of radio frequency identification, or RFID, to track inventory as it flows through the supply chain. RFID technology comes in 2 basic types. One type is what's called active RFID. Active RFID involves attaching a small device to each product. The device has its own battery power source and is capable of emitting a signal to indicate its location so the product can be tracked. This is the technology used in the transport of very large items, like military armaments and shipping containers. The second type of RFID is the one gaining greater attention in recent years, and that's the passive RFID. This technology has been called barcodes on steroids, as it's regarded as a much improved method over traditional barcode technology, found on virtually every carton and package sold today. The passive RFID tag can hold much more data than the traditional barcode, providing a unique identifier for that specific item and unit. With the added memory capacity, one can track not only the unique ID for that unit, but also indicate the production date, lot number, as well as any other special data like whether the good has hazardous or recyclable content. Electronic readers are positioned at the inbound and outbound doors of facilities, and these readers send energy to the passive RFID tag. This energy activates the tag, which sends a signal back to the reader with all the data encoded in the tag. Since the whole process is automated, require no human involvement, hundreds of items can be read at once. This compares favorably to traditional barcodes, which can only be read one at a time, and often rely on people with handheld scanners to correctly scan each unit in and out of inventory. And I'm sure you've seen the person running the checkout counter at your grocery store who from time to time will casually scan one item several times instead of scanning each item, even though you might have somewhat different items in your cart, like different colors or flavors. Guess what? This really messes up the inventory counts on that stuff. So RFID promises to take care of these types of data entry problems. Clearly, the potential for RFID technology is immense. Not long ago, it was believed that virtually everything we buy would use this technology by now. Aggressive mandates were initiated by companies like Walmart, Target, and even the U.S. Department of Defense back in the mid-2000s. But the use of RFID has yet to achieve its expected results. Some claim that the economics are not yet in place, that it remains too expensive for use. Others claim that the technology is not yet ready, that the readers are unable to capture all the data for large volumes of items at once, thereby suggesting that the technology doesn't justify the investment. But keep a close eye on RFID. New applications seemingly crop up every day where it is used effectively. Another technological innovation that could affect inventory management dramatically is three-dimensional printing. Being able to create form on the spot has tremendous implications for what we stock in inventory and where we stock it. Among the more exciting developments is its prospective use in the production of on-demand medical devices and even artificial body parts. We're only starting to get our heads around how this technology could alter our businesses, create new opportunities, and yes, change the way we think about inventory. Rather than stocking products in their final form and position,